I want to briefly just explain how we're going to do the voting here. You have a clicker in front of you. They have to be turned on. If you don't turn the power on, then your vote will not register. So you'll turn them on. If for any reason you don't see a green light come on, please raise your hand and a member of my staff will come around and swap out your clicker. Although they have several different letters on them, we're only voting yes or no. So if you press A, you're going to get the yes. If you press B, I think you're going to get no. The question will go up in a minute. If you press like C, D, and E, it's meaningless, so please don't. We have a lot of people in the room, and I hope that you are all going to vote. This is really anonymous. You know, and in prior years, sometimes, you know, people think, you know, well, you're diplomats or something, and you shouldn't. But please, weigh in. We'd really like to hear your views. While the voting period takes place, which will be about 60 to 90 seconds, you can change your vote. But if you keep pressing the same letter, you're not going to get 10 votes. You're only going to get one. When I say that the votes are locked in, then you can no longer change your vote. When you do leave today, please leave the clickers on the table. They're not going to work with your television sets or your computers at home. They cost us a lot of money. And we use them for many of our events that we have here, and we find that audience participation is really a useful part of this particular event. So you will all have the opportunity to vote for this proposition before the debate and after the debate. And then after you vote the first time, each one of our speakers will have up to 15 minutes to make their case. We will then go back to each of the speakers for 5 minutes to rebut or comment on what the other speaker has said. And then we're going to open the floor to you to ask questions. And I'm going to ask that any question that comes from the audience be directly pertinent to the proposition. We are actually trying to ask speakers to elaborate on their points, to more effectively defend their position. So please don't ask something on an extraneous and irrelevant issue. Okay, I think that's all I have to say about the clickers. We're going to move to the first question. The question is, the proposition is U.S. engagement policy toward China has failed. So while I'm giving you an introduction to this proposition, you may all begin voting. Since President Nixon's visit to China in the early 1970s, U.S. policy toward China has centered on engagement as a means to achieve key objectives. And as many of you know, in the March-April 2018 issue of Foreign Affairs, Kurt Campbell and Eli Ratner argued that U.S. engagement policy failed to change China in the ways we had intended or hoped, and was built on wrong assumptions and unrealistic expectations. Engagement, they concluded, failed to produce increased political and economic openness in China or bind China sufficiently to the liberal international order. In a subsequent issue of Foreign Affairs, several leading China scholars critiqued this thesis that Kurt Campbell and Eli Ratner put forward, and one of those scholars was Ambassador Stape Roy, who first became involved in formulating and implementing U.S. policy toward China in the 1970s, and of course later served as ambassador to China in the 1990s. And we are privileged to have both Dr. Ratner and Ambassador Roy with us today to debate the proposition, U.S. engagement policy toward China has failed. You all have their bios. Dr. Ratner is Executive Vice President and Director of Studies at the Center for New American Security, and Ambassador Roy, again, former ambassador to China, founding director emeritus, and distinguished scholar at the Kissinger Institute on China and the United States at the Woodrow Wilson Center. So we are going to lock in the votes now. And we are going to start with the person who is arguing for the proposition. So we'll begin with Eli Ratner. U.S. engagement policy toward China has failed.
Okay. Thank you, Bonnie. It's great to see everyone this morning. I'm heartened to see we had 65% at the top. I feel like I've already won, but we'll see where this goes. It's probably only down from here, but that number probably would have been radically different even 2 years ago. So things are changing here in Washington. And let me just say it's an honor to be on the stage with Ambassador Roy as well, who's been so important to this relationship and did such great service for the United States. So what are we debating here this morning? What we're debating, and my argument would be, that by the end of the Obama administration, it was clear that the old policy of engagement wasn't working anymore, and that we need a different strategy toward China than the one that we had pursued for the last 30 years. As Bonnie had mentioned, the old policy of engagement was undergirded by the belief that China would gradually become more liberal, more open, more integrated, and would broadly accept the existing international system, Bob Zoellick's famous formulation of the responsible stakeholder here. Unfortunately, however, the gap between these aspirations and China's actual evolution has only grown wider, and that this divergence calls for a reassessment of U.S. strategy, given that convergence and the expectation of convergence was at the very heart of engagement and is no longer occurring. So we need a new approach. So that's my argument. The old policy of engagement wasn't working anymore, and that we need a different strategy. But before we go any further, I want to first outline what I'm not arguing and what I think we're not debating here, because I've been engaged in these debates for years now, intensely over the last several months, and there are a lot of straw men that are put forward about the kind of arguments that I and others are making. First, I'm not arguing about the Cold War period. I think there's broad agreement that that was an important strategic move. Ambassador Roy was at the middle of that, was a huge success, and by no means should be characterized as a failure. I'm not arguing that U.S.-China policy was a total or utter failure, and that nothing good came from U.S. engagement. There were huge economic benefits. We managed a very complicated situation with Taiwan, and there were important cooperation on issues like climate change and nonproliferation. And I recognize that there were a number of different motivations for U.S.-China policy. I'm not arguing that people were naive. The context has changed, not that people were naive when they were making policy. And until recently, there actually was more evidence, or at least more ambiguity, that the policy was working, though that has changed. And I'm not arguing in favor of the Trump administration's approach. And there's been a terrible habit of conflating critiques of the engagement policy as somehow an endorsement of President Trump, and criticism of turning away from the engagement policy by locking on to things that the Trump administration is doing incorrectly. Turning away from engagement by no means means embracing the entirety of Donald Trump's foreign policy. So with those caveats, let me get back to the question about the efficacy of the policy of engagement. And I think over the last decade in particular, contrary to our hopes and our expectations, we've seen expressions of Chinese illiberalism, authoritarianism, and revisionism that are new and that run directly counter to U.S. interests. And they're occurring in nearly every dimension of international politics, diplomatic, informational and ideological, military and economic. So how did the policy of engagement fare during this period, which I saw firsthand during the Obama administration at the State Department, on the China desk, and then later in the White House? I'd say not very well. Obama, of course, saw China as a partner. He sought to stabilize the relationship on several fronts. And while there were some gains on transnational issues, some of which I've already mentioned, on most issues of consequence, the mode of engagement wasn't working. And in fact, Beijing rejected nearly every attempt by the United States to resolve important areas of dispute. On economics, China dragged its feet for almost a decade on a bilateral investment treaty that would have addressed a number of the issues at the root of today's trade war, never negotiating in good faith and coming forward with a serious proposal. On economic reforms, Xi Jinping made enormous promises in 2013 that he never delivered on, that would have opened markets for U.S. businesses and resolved many of the issues today. And on cyber espionage, through a policy of engagement, the United States and China reached an agreement in the fall of 2015 to cease and desist, after which a short period, China resumed intensive and illegal cyber espionage for commercial grain. On the security side, of course, in the South China Sea, Xi Jinping famously lied in the White House Rose Garden next to President Obama, saying China had no intention to militarize the South China Sea. Of course, we know that isn't true. On North Korea, years and years and years of engagement in diplomacy never brought China to the table to apply the kind of pressure that we saw in the last couple of years, once they were under much more duress. And of course, with allies and partners, China systematically tried to undermine U.S. alliances throughout the region, despite U.S. efforts to engage China on security issues. On political issues and human rights issues, of course, we all know Xi Jinping's record has been absolutely abysmal. China is currently in the process of exporting its illiberalism and surveillance state to developing countries around the world. And of course, we know, or maybe not everyone in the world knows, but there are incredible human rights violations occurring in Xinjiang now, in Western China, which are a real moral atrocity and in and of themselves probably would call for a reassessment of the U.S.-China relationship separate from everything else that we're discussing today. On issue after issue after issue, U.S. policy of engagement did little to curb any of this behavior and was instead creating a permissive environment for Chinese assertiveness and Chinese revisionism. Beijing pocketed concessions and gains and pushed harder rather than seeking to meet the United States halfway. Washington, meanwhile, under its policy of engagement, remained highly risk-averse and too focused on the relationship itself, often focused on maintaining positive ties, which took precedent at times over advancing other U.S. interests. And most importantly, because of the essential assumption of convergence, the policy of engagement had no answer to what the United States should do if China steps outside of our expectations. Ultimately, the policy of engagement was a theory about how to prevent the China challenge. But it had no response when a China challenge arose, which is where we are today. Facing a more liberal, more authoritarian, and more revisionist China for which the traditional policy of engagement and integration simply has no theory of success. Yet there are still those arguing that this isn't a problem, that Chinese liberalism and revisionism is something we can live with, and that China policy should go on business as usual. And there are maybe more, I think, very generally, two camps that folks in the audience who voted in the negative here would probably fall into, one of these categories. The first is what I would call the don't worry about it camp. And the don't worry about it camp says, you know what, don't worry about expanding Chinese power, a Chinese sphere of influence, because China's ultimately going to want what we want. They're not really going to have a particularly illiberal sense to their foreign policy. And furthermore, Beijing doesn't have designs on regional dominance or sphere of influence or regional hegemony. Just listen to what they say. They're not interested in that. The other side of the don't worry about it camp says that regardless of China's aspirations, that there are huge barriers to their ability to expand their power, that there are internal contradictions within China that will slow its rise, combined with external restraints, including other major powers who don't want to live under a China-dominated region, and therefore there are strict limits to China's ability to shape the region and the world, even if it wanted to. So that's the don't worry about it camp. The other camp is the get used to it camp, that sees Chinese power as natural, as legitimate, as inevitable, sees the United States in relative decline, and believes there's nothing the United States can or should do about it. Another version of the get used to it camp is the Thucydides trap crowd, which argues that it's just too risky, that war avoidance should be the principal aim of U.S.-China policy, and that therefore that should lead to a policy of accommodation, given China's demonstrated ability to manipulate risk, that we should just accept China's liberal sphere of influence and growing power because it's too dangerous to do otherwise. Now, obviously, I don't subscribe to either the don't worry about it or the get used to it camp. I am worried about it. I see huge risks in a liberal sphere of influence, a Chinese liberal sphere of influence, and I don't buy the argument that it wouldn't be such a big deal for the United States. And I think, in fact, we're already seeing the roots of this kind of a China-led sphere of influence taking order in parts of Asia and parts of the developing world. And the result of that for the United States is weaker alliances, fewer security partners, and a military forced to operate at greater distances, U.S. firms without access to markets and leading technologies, disadvantaged by new standards, investment rules, and trading blocks, inert regional institutions that are largely unable to resist Chinese coercion, and a steady decline in democracy and individual freedoms around the world. The net result of all this, if it is allowed to continue, will be a less secure and less prosperous United States that would be less able to exert power in the world. So the stakes, in my view, are extremely high if we don't develop a more sophisticated strategy. And I'm not comforted by arguments that internal or external factors will retard China's ability to dominate the region, especially in the absence of a stronger U.S. strategy. We should assume that China's economy is going to slow down. Of course, we know it's growing several percentage points lower than what the government says it is. And China is bound to face external resistance. But the reality is that its power is still expanding. And I see things like the blowback on the Belt and Road or otherwise that get a lot of media attention in the United States as much more two steps forward, one step back for China's liberal sphere of influence than it is rolling China's power backwards. And in fact, in the region, I see just as much bandwagoning as I do balancing against China. To the get used to it camp, I'll end on a more optimistic note, which is that I firmly believe that the United States, with its allies and partners standing by its values, can prevent China from establishing an illiberal order, and we can do so without provoking armed conflict. The foundations of American power are strong. China isn't 10 feet tall. And in fact, the only reason they've been making the kind of advances we've seen over the last several years is because the United States hasn't been competing at all. In the final analysis, the policy of engagement predicated on convergence and integration is no longer valid in theory or in practice. The China challenge of today is not the China challenge for which the policy of engagement was designed, and we need a new approach. Thank you all very much.
Ambassador Roy, you're up.
Okay. Good morning. And thank you, Eli, for that very good presentation. We're debating today the proposition that U.S. engagement policy toward China has failed. Failed. Pay attention to that word. I fundamentally disagree with this proposition for a variety of reasons. First, it's factually inaccurate. At the moment, it has not failed. It has been abandoned, except at the margins. The proposition that engagement has failed because it has demonstratively not induced China to become a liberal democracy, as some have argued, does not stand up to scrutiny. Our engagement policy with El Salvador has failed, obviously, because we're being invaded by people close to our things. We haven't been able to straighten out Cuba. In other words, our engagement policy everywhere turns out that we can't simply alter domestic developments in foreign countries, something that every diplomat knows is not within the power of U.S. diplomacy to do. You can't base failure on such prognostications. Second, suggesting that engagement with China has failed begs the question of what the alternatives are to engagement. If engagement has failed, what then should our policy be? Containment? Confrontation? These would be worst-case outcomes that would make conflict more likely, magnify contradictions between the United States and the interests of our allies and friends in East Asia, and make it more difficult to seek a balance in East Asia that can accommodate the interests of both China and the United States. Speaking of failure is the wrong way to address the question. Not all engagement policies are created equal. Some may be too weak, too accommodating, where a firmer approach would be more effective in advancing U.S. interests. If the latter, then we would need to restate the proposition. U.S. engagement toward policy needs improvement. Yes, I agree with that. But to equate a less than perfect engagement policy with failure is simply not an accurate way of looking at the question. In the vast majority of circumstances, engagement like honesty is the best policy. Cooperation and rivalry are both inherent in relations among nation states. As Americans, we are fortunate that the traditional American conviction has been that the normal pattern of international relations is harmonious. I spent 45 years as an American diplomat. That's more than 20% of our history as a nation. And I found that even in the worst circumstances, there were possibilities for engagement. 35 years of my Foreign Service career was during the Cold War. And over that span of time, I spent 9 years dealing with the Soviet Union and 13 years with the People's Republic of China, our two principal communist adversaries. I was negotiating in both places because we were engaged on a variety of different issues. Even during the darkest days of the Cold War, we were deeply engaged with the Soviets, for example, and this produced periodic episodes of détente. Ultimately, it was détente that fostered the circumstances that led to the disintegration of the Soviet Union. Sure, containment boxed in the Soviet Union, but it was Gorbachev and his glasnost policies, supported by détente, that ultimately resulted in a collapse of that principal adversary of ours. In the case of China, it was the absence of engagement during the period from 1949 to 1969, except for the sporadic and unproductive contacts we maintained in Geneva and Warsaw, that caused the Nixon administration to lose precious months trying to figure out how to communicate securely with Beijing. Dr. Kissinger can tell wonderful stories about all of the different channels we tried to use, none of which was secure. Because we hadn't been engaged with China, we didn't even know how to talk to them. Keeping the engagement option open is important, because there's too much loose talk about the growing strategic rivalry between China and the United States and how the two countries would fare in an all-out war situation. The answer is, both would fare very badly. The logic of deterrence based on mutual assured destruction applies in the US-China case, just as it did in the US-Soviet case. Direct conflict between China and the United States is too dangerous for either country to be able to undertake it, except for some gigantic problem between us that doesn't exist. Oh, just a minute. Taiwan could be such an issue, as could lesser territorial disputes. But we have a policy framework that removes them as war-fighting issues. We recognize the PRC is the sole legal government of China. We acknowledge the Chinese position that Taiwan is part of China. We took no position on sovereignty over the islands, rocks, and shoals in dispute in the East and South China Sea. Unless we tinker with that framework, we are not in confrontation with China on these issues. Our engagement with China has not failed. On the contrary, if not perfect in every respect, it has been good for the United States in big ways and small ways. Through engagement, we swung China to our side in the Cold War. We gained access to the world's largest market. US consumers benefited from a flood of lower cost, higher quality goods, which helped keep inflation low. We exposed vast numbers of China's current and future leaders to how modern systems of governance function. In the process, these future and some of the current leaders became more conscious of the deficiencies of China's pre-modern form of governance, which is based on the outmoded concept that kings, tsars, and communist parties have the divine right to keep all power in their own hands without a legitimization process based on the consent of the governed. Not surprisingly, Xi Jinping is sufficiently disturbed by this ideological threat to have launched a campaign against Western influences. He's also reverting to repressive measures to curb the influence of modern political concepts of governance. In the process, he is exacerbating the contradiction in China between China's modernized economy and society and China's pre-modern form of governance. At the G20 meetings in Argentina that will take place this weekend, only China and Saudi Arabia lack an electoral process of legitimization. Even Iran has one. Engagement is important for other reasons as well. The dynamic of engagement is to be constantly on the lookout for productive areas of cooperation and to make problems more manageable. The dynamic of containment is to close off areas of cooperation. Non-engagement virtually guarantees missed opportunities. Let's consider a key example. At the conclusion of his book on China, Dr. Kissinger has a chapter on the Crow Memorandum, written in 1907 by a senior British Foreign Office official, nearly a decade before the outbreak of World War I. 15 years earlier, Germany and Britain had been close friends. Now they were heading for confrontation. In his memorandum, Crow brilliantly analyzed Germany's rise and what this meant for Great Britain. He concluded that Germany was seeking a general political hegemony and maritime ascendancy, threatening the independence of its neighbors and ultimately the existence of England. Sound familiar? Some people talk about China that way. Germany's intentions, in his view, precluded cooperation or even trust. In short, Crow concluded that engagement had failed. There was no longer any scope for diplomacy to head off the inevitable confrontation. 7 years later, Germany and Great Britain were at war, a conflict that would devastate his country, fatally weaken the British Empire, and sow the seeds of World War II. To cite a current parallel, in testimony to Congress a year ago, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, General Dunford, said that the greatest immediate threats to the United States are Russia and North Korea, but that by 2025, China will pose the greatest threat. Quote, greatest threat. He saw China as focused on limiting the U.S. ability to project power and on weakening U.S. alliances in the Pacific. In his view, China's military modernization is targeting capabilities with the potential to degrade core U.S. military technological advantages. All true. General Dunford was focusing, as he should, on China's growing military capabilities. But what he did not say is equally important. Can we have a non-threatening relationship with such a China? Should we assume that a more powerful China will automatically pose a threat to the United States? That's a challenge for our diplomacy, which gets little attention and even less money. I was serving in the U.S. Embassy in Moscow in the early 1970s when a few deft moves by President Nixon swung China to our side in the Cold War. China's military capabilities at the time did not change, but all of a sudden they were not threatening to the United States. What is our policy to try to make a stronger and more prosperous China less threatening to the United States? If you don't have an engagement policy, you are giving up the opportunity to get a better outcome. My Cold War experience suggests that we are not doomed like lemmings to march toward confrontation with China. There are better alternatives. A properly conceived engagement strategy can assure that we do not treat bad outcomes as inevitable. Against this background, the United States faces a fundamental policy choice regarding our strategy in dealing with China. Should the goal of our policy be to preserve our traditional air and sea dominance in the Western Pacific? Or should the goal be the encouragement of responsible behavior by a more powerful and influential China? We are not yet addressing this choice in a serious fashion. In the first case, we may find ourselves competing with a China that has a larger GDP than the United States, and which is capable of allocating more public funds to the non-military components of its national security strategy. Think about that. We devote virtually nothing to the non-military aspects of our national security strategy. China is pouring hundreds of billions of dollars into those very areas. In the latter case, we would need to preserve a military presence in the Western Pacific sufficient to deter intimidating or domineering Chinese behavior. While expanding cooperation with China in the many areas where our interests overlap, the goal should be equilibrium that makes physical domination difficult. That's well within the reach of skillful diplomacy. It's not the same thing as dominance. Nevertheless, we should not underestimate the size of the challenge. China is willing and eager to step into the global leadership role that the United States is moving away from. In the words of President Xi Jinping, the Chinese people have turned away from being passive to being active. By mid-century, he projects that China will become a country whose comprehensive national power and international influence will be at the forefront. The Chinese People's Army will rank among the top militaries in the world, And in his words, the Chinese nation then will stand tall among the nations of the world with an even more high-spirited attitude. That's the challenge. It's far more than military. China is outspending us in every non-military sphere of comprehensive national power. We cannot meet that challenge by running up budget deficits, beggaring our children, degrading our infrastructure, and by default, using our military power to address issues that are not amenable to military solutions. The harsh reality is that the United States has poorly utilized the possibilities provided by our dominant position in the post-Cold War world. The 2008 financial crisis and the exorbitant costs of the disruptive U.S. military interventions in the Middle East have strained U.S. budgetary resources, polarized U.S. society, degraded U.S. infrastructure, and mired us in an emerging political crisis that could have far-reaching implications. Despite these difficulties, the United States still has the world's most powerful and battle-tested military forces, an innovative and productive economy, superb tertiary education, and an ability to rise to challenges when all other possibilities have been exhausted. Clearly then, U.S.-China relations should be at the center of our foreign policy concerns and handled with realism and creativity. We are not passing that test. Our current national security strategy has designated China and Russia as revisionist powers, bent on replacing the current so-called liberal international order with one more to their liking. This is a flawed conception. China recognizes that the current order enabled its economy to grow at breathtaking speed. In his speeches, President Xi Jinping has made clear he's not out to upset the international order, but rather to adapt it and supplement it, better to reflect the interests of China and other rising countries. International orders aren't static. If new countries rise, international orders have to adjust. China is calling for adjustment, not overthrow. As one of the five permanent members of the UN Security Council, China has a favored position in the current order that it is loath to give up. Why should China stop being one of the five permanent members of the UN Security Council? Major countries such as Japan, India, Brazil, Germany, and Indonesia feel excluded from their rightful place in the order, but we don't label them as revisionists. As a first step, we need to develop concepts which will help us contribute to a revised and more stable international order for the future. Neither China nor the United States is addressing this fundamental issue properly. In a speech 4 years ago, President Xi Jinping stated that China should be keenly aware of the protracted nature of the contest over the international order. Contest. Why did he use that word? Any stable international order must accommodate the interests of both China and the United States, along with the interests of other members of the international community. Creating such an order through adaptation and creativity should be viewed as a common interest of China and the United States, not as a contest between them. Only through engagement with China can we work together on such a fundamental task. In conclusion, as Dr. Kissinger wrote 50 years ago, the best and most prideful expressions of American purposes in the world have been those in which we acted in concert with others. Our influence in these situations has depended on achieving a reputation as a member of such a concert. To act consistently abroad, we must be able to generate coalitions of shared purposes. And in this world, part of that coalition needs to be China, along with the United States. For nearly 40 years, East Asia has been free of major military conflict. Properly conceived and implemented engagement with China can extend this period, perhaps indefinitely, while fostering regional prosperity and stability. That should be our goal. For most Americans, our country has always stood for something more than our own grandeur. Engagement provides the best means of turning that concept into reality. Thank you.
We're now going to give each speaker 5 minutes to respond to the other, and we begin with Eli Ratner.
Great. Thanks so much. And Stape, that was terrific. I think I agree with a lot of what he said, so maybe I'll just pull out some of the areas of disagreement. The first would be obviously that this debate and discussion is hinging on the definition of engagement. If engagement just means diplomacy and dialogue, then everybody's in favor of engagement. I don't know anybody, well, there may be some, but very few people in the expert strategy community are arguing that we should cut off diplomacy and dialogue with China. In fact, those who see an emerging strategic competition understand the importance of diplomacy and dialogue as central to ensuring stability during that time, that type of competition. So the policy of engagement is not a policy that includes dialogue and diplomacy. The policy of engagement was a largely bipartisan consensus China policy over the last 30 years that included military balancing to prevent Chinese overt aggression, combined with economic, diplomatic, and commercial interactions under the assumption that those would lead to a convergence of U.S. and Chinese interests, would narrow differences, and would enhance cooperation, and would do precisely the thing that Ambassador Roy identified as the goal of making China's behavior more responsible. My argument is that hasn't happened. That didn't work in the South China Sea. In 2015, when I was in the White House and the PCA, the arbitration ruling, was coming out, there was a big debate in the White House Situation Room that I was part of. And there were folks like me arguing, you know what? We need to think about how to pressure the Chinese, because simply pleading with them to abide by the ruling is not going to be enough, or wagging your finger and telling them why abiding by international law is actually in their interest in the long run is not going to work. And the prevailing argument that won the day and what we saw as U.S. policy was no, we're going to talk to them quietly, we're not going to push them in the corner, and we're going to give them the political space they need to over time accept that ruling. And what they did instead is they came out and they said, this ruling isn't worth the paper it's written on, and they threw it out and they ripped it up and they continued on the path that they've been on otherwise. And we've seen that on issue after issue after issue. On the economic issue, we've been hearing for decades promises and promises and promises from the Clinton administration to the Bush administration, through the Obama administration, about how China was on the cusp of opening its markets, and if only we engaged with them and had just a little bit more dialogue and a little bit more diplomacy, then right around the corner, that was going to be sufficient to narrow our differences. And it didn't. And it didn't. And it's not lost on anybody. It is not lost on anybody that the concessions that Xi Jinping is going to put on the table on Saturday in Buenos Aires will be way beyond what China was willing to offer after 30 years of diplomacy. Think about that. What does that say about the efficacy of a policy simply predicated on the fact that dialogue is going to be the only way through which we're going to try to curb Chinese behavior? It simply didn't work. So I think the facts are straight. We need to be looking for a new approach. The question of what are the alternatives is a good one, and that is the intellectual challenge of our era. And we should not fall back on old concepts and say, well, we don't like those strategies of old, and therefore we can't abandon this strategy that isn't working. This is everyone in this room, and particularly the young folks. It is the challenge of our generation to think about what are the new concepts for this strategy. Nobody's talking about dominance. The National Defense Strategy, which was the most forward-leaning, hawkish US government document in decades, said explicitly, from a military perspective, the United States is not seeking dominance in East Asia. It's precisely seeking what Ambassador Roy described as an environment in which there is some equilibrium in which no country can dominate the entire region. And what we're seeing now is a slide away from that. The US policy of engagement was not producing that result. So as it relates to, I guess, make just one other point, and then I'll sit down because I'm interested to hear from the audience, which is this question of military conflict. Because you do hear this argument that anything moving away from engagement is likely to increase the likelihood of armed conflict. This is, again, at the root of the Thucydides trap. It's at the root of many advocates of a policy of accommodation. I think they get the logic exactly wrong. And in fact, the accommodation of the United States, the permissive environment that has created Chinese revisionism and assertiveness in the East China Sea, in the South China Sea, throughout parts of Asia, is radically increasing the likelihood of war down the road. The farther China goes in trying to establish effective control or dominance of the South China Sea increases the likelihood of war down the road, then would have the United States, having stood up for itself 5 years ago in the South China Sea and drawn a red line from some of this revisionist behavior. So the idea, what we're doing by permitting, again, this permissive environment of Chinese illiberalism and revisionism is kicking the can down the road such that when we need to deal with it, the stakes and the costs will be enormously higher. They're higher today than they were 5 years ago, which is why we should have done 5 years ago some of what we're doing today, much less 10 years ago. But we are where we are, and we ought not kick the can down the road by believing that we're going to be safer by accommodating a Chinese sphere of influence in Asia. So let me stop there and look forward to your comments.
Okay. Ambassador Roy, 5 minutes.
Eli has made good points, but let's try to look at this in a
fundamental way. There are two aspects to this. One hinges on the question of to what degree is the United States responsible for the domestic behavior of foreign countries. Think about that. We had slavery in the United States for how many years? I guess it lasted until the middle 1860s. Then we had Jim Crow laws for the next 100 years. Picture yourself as a foreign country. What should your policy toward the United States have been in order to force the Americans to give up slavery and stop our mistreatment of our minority populations? Can you imagine a meeting in Saudi Arabia of right-wing religious leaders who were concerned about the rise of the religious right in the United States and trying to develop a policy to straighten out the religious right and decrease its political influence? Well, a lot of this discussion about engagement with China has to do with the fact that we can't change China's internal behavior the way we would like to. But we can't do it in Haiti, we can't do it in Cuba, we can't do it in El Salvador, we can't do it in Mexico. We couldn't even keep Mexico from preventing the refugees who were invading our country, so we had to send troops to the border. We couldn't prevent them from doing that. That's not what diplomacy and that's not what engagement is about. It's not changing the behavior domestically of how other countries handle their affairs. We can't do it. We can influence it at the margins, and in some cases we've had enormous influence. And one of the points I made is that Xi Jinping is wrestling with a problem, that modern concepts of governance are incompatible with the current way that China is being ruled. And the way he's trying to deal with that problem is to curb the influence of Western ideas. Well, it was engagement that brought those Western ideas into China, and it's not going to go away. So, think about these factors. When I went to China as ambassador, I spent a half hour in the Oval Office with President Bush and Brent Scowcroft, and we discussed what to do about China. He never once raised the idea of making China into a liberal democracy. Too bad, I was looking for challenges. He didn't give it to me. But the Clinton administration kept me on in China as ambassador, and they gave me instructions. Yeah. They said, we want fundamental improvements in 7 areas of human rights in 1 year. 1 year. Well, that was the challenge I was looking for. So I talked to the Chinese, and we laid out a game plan to try to get improvement in 7 different areas. I couldn't get any guidance from Washington on what we would do if China did all the things that we wanted them to do. Why? Because there was a disagreement in Washington between the economic interests and the non-economic interests, and I couldn't get any cables out saying if China gives us everything we want, we will do this. How do you negotiate under those circumstances? What I'm trying to do, and incidentally, every one of those 7 areas of human rights was violated by the United States when we got scared by the 9/11 attacks. We hid people from the International Committee of the Red Cross. We did not have habeas corpus, et cetera, et cetera. I can run through the list. So when countries are scared, they behave badly in handling their domestic affairs. We've just been reading stories about putting American citizens in concentration camps, like in Xinjiang, throughout World War II. These were American citizens. They just happened to be Japanese Americans. When you're scared, you behave badly. And China is scared about some of its domestic problems, and it behaves badly. The United States can't straighten those types of questions out through engagement or non-engagement policies. So that's one aspect. The other aspect is China behaving differently than other rising powers? And the answer is, unfortunately, no, it's not. We have the examples of Germany and Japan. We have the United States. Remember the Spanish-American War? We seized colonies. It was while we were receiving colonies that we actually annexed Hawaii and made it part of the United States that had been independent prior to that. Rising countries have certain patterns of behavior, and China is showing those patterns of behavior. So the challenge is, how do you deal with countries? Because when you get stronger and richer, you become more self-confident. You become more eager to have other people defer to your own interests. And China is showing all of those characteristics. Can we deal with it? The answer is yes. Not every country falls into a Thucydides trap. The United States more or less rose peacefully, partly because we were off in the Western Hemisphere and we weren't challenging our neighbors. We were already the hegemonic power, not because of conquest, but because the colonial empires had vanished and the remaining countries were simply weaker than we were. In some cases, Chile had a better navy until the end of the 19th century, which deterred us from going to war with Chile because we couldn't protect San Francisco. Interesting little bit of history. So I just want to illustrate that the real problem here is a lot of the criticism of engagement hinges on our inability to straighten out domestic situations in other countries. It's a wrong standard by which to judge our policies.
Excellent. Okay, we are now going to open the floor for questions, and please make them short, make them questions. This is not an opportunity to express your own views. We are really trying to get into this proposition as to whether U.S. engagement policy toward China has failed. Identify yourself, wait for the microphone. Who would like to ask the first question? Okay, over here, this gentleman right there.
Peter Humphrey, intel analyst and a former diplomat. The Communist Party believes that the Chinese people are so stupid that they don't deserve a choice. We don't agree with that. And do we think that the Communist Party will endure forever? And if not, are there things we can do to accelerate the end of the Communist Party over China? And isn't that kind of one of the alternative strategies? Think about things like breaking the Great Wall censorship system.
Okay, I think what I'll do is I'll take three questions. So if you would write that down, can we or should we overthrow the Communist Party? Is that really the question? I think that's essentially what you're asking. Okay, we'll go to Jung Sung over right there.
Jay Ru, One Korea
okay,
Foundation.
Tried.
The U.S.-China relations is not just a concern for Americans and Chinese. The whole world is watching, especially around the people surrounding China. In South Korea today,
you need to, I'm sorry.
And pro-U.S.
I'm sorry, you need
fighting.
To ask a question.
I want to ask you whether what they want a new policy from the United States, whether it's just an improvement, as Ambassador says, or whether it is a total acceptance of a failure and new policy, whatever it is, there needs to be a change. Where does this position hold in this debate? I don't know.
Okay, gentlemen over there, please. And then we will come back and hopefully we'll have time
Thank
for
you.
Three
My
more.
Name is Song Zhang with Shanghai Wenhui Daily. And we are hearing a lot of new words to describe the current U.S. policy toward China. We hear the decoupling, Cold War containment, obviously also engagement. I want the two panelists to pick one from these kind of words. If you don't accept all of them, what is the word you want to describe? Thank you.
Okay, Eli, you want to start?
Why don't Dave start on the question of will the Chinese Communist Party endure forever?
Okay, will the Chinese Communist Party endure forever? Should we have a strategy to overthrow it? I think that was what I don't think that was my words. I think that was the question.
Nothing endures forever. and we should not have a strategy to overthrow it. Quite frankly, the Westphalian system of nation states is based on the concept that you deal with other countries in terms of their external behavior and you do not interfere in their internal affairs. We have created other concepts, such as humanitarian intervention, which justify interference in the internal affairs of other countries. This is not a basis for an international principle, because you can only have humanitarian interventions when the strong impose it on the weak. And any system of international law and rules has to be based on equal treatment for all countries. We don't like it. So we've created a concept that justifies big powers intervening in weak powers and straightening out their situations. That's what we did in Serbia, and we've done it in various other weak countries, but we don't apply it to big, strong countries. So therefore, it's not a principle of international law. It's a justification for what the strong do. As Thucydides said, the strong do what they will, the weak do what they must. That's not a good concept of international behavior. So we may not like the Chinese communist system, but it's not our job to tell the Chinese people how they should be ruled. It's up to them to come up with those concepts. What I have illustrated in my remarks is that when we expose people to how modern governance systems function, it has resonance in China, and that causes reactions in China that create difficulties for a system of governance that does not legitimize itself through the consent of the governed. And that's what we're seeing in China. But it's not an inevitable process. You don't know whether they wins or loses. That depends on the circumstances in the individual countries. In some cases, it works, and in some cases, it doesn't. Let me end on that note.
Maybe I'll just pick up one piece of this question, because you mentioned the question of penetrating the Chinese Great Firewall and getting more information into China. Not on the question of regime change, but I would say, you know, if you're a devotee of the policy of engagement, then you believe that over time there's going to be a natural arc toward greater openness. And we saw that with the media and others in China throughout the 1980s. In the 1990s, that has not only stopped, it's reversed. And I think as we're thinking about alternative strategies, I would kind of conceive of them of enhancing American competitiveness, and the United States becoming more competitive in various domains of international politics. The ideological and informational domain is one of those domains the United States doesn't have to compete in if you think the policy of engagement is working, because the processes of economic and social integration with China will do your work for you in terms of information and ideas getting into China. If you believe, as I think is an empirical fact, that it's harder to get ideas into China naturally, that there's less internal debate in China, then I do think the United States needs to think about what does a policy that includes strategic messaging and information operations include to try to shape that debate and to try to compete with China, not only within China, but actually much more importantly in Asia and around the world, where the Chinese are competing very vigorously in terms of state-led propaganda, and the United States hasn't been exercising this muscle since the Cold War. So I think that's a specific area where if you had a transition away from a policy of engagement that was predicated on some of these expectations of openness and convergence, that you'd have to think about the United States being a little more proactively competitive in some of these important domains of international politics.
Let me point out an irony just briefly. There are some articles in the morning paper about Chinese influence operations in the United States. We've just had some discussion about the need for U.S. influence operations in China. Now, are our influence operations good and Chinese influence operations bad? It's one thing to talk about free debate. If China tries to control a freedom of discussion on a university campus by saying you can't say anything about Taiwan, it's always been part of China's territory, you can't discuss whether and how it should be, et cetera, that's bad, because that's not consistent with our concept of how it ought to be done. But if China teaches Chinese, lets us know more about Chinese history and culture, we had a U.S. information agency for years that was designed to influence attitudes in foreign countries, and that was perfectly legitimate. So I think we have to think providing equipment for Chinese to break through their firewalls, if it were done in reverse to the United States, would create an enormous back reaction. We don't like foreign interference in our elections. Guess what? There's an investigation going on now about that particular type of thing. So this is a bigger question than US and China. We're talking about what are appropriate measures for countries to take in terms of dealing with things that they don't like that are occurring in other countries. It requires a lot of careful thought.
I think the other question, which really is for you, Eli, since you are arguing that the proposition in favor of that U.S. engagement has failed, if you were to give another label, bumper sticker, what should the policy be? And you've explained it, but is there a term you would use for it?
The way that I think about the problem, I mean, I've written about this even just this week, is that yeah. The cardinal aim of U.S.-China policy should be enhancing American competitiveness to prevent an illiberal Chinese sphere of influence in Asia. And what's interesting about that, people sort of, you know, get shocked at this concept of preventing a sphere of influence. Sounds a little bit like containment. I don't think it is. But it's actually a much less aggressive and confrontational approach toward China than is trying to integrate them into a liberal order, which would violate so many of China's core interests. So in some ways, you know, I think the idea of this is going to be an American-led, American-dominated order, and China has to conform to America's liberal institutions domestically and internationally, that's not what I'm arguing. In fact, that's the policy of engagement, right? What I'm arguing is, no, in fact, what we need to do is we need to enhance American competitiveness to prevent this outcome of a Chinese liberal sphere of influence. The word containment, I don't think, is a useful one because, for one thing, there were so many different versions of containment during the Cold War that people will associate the one that they think best or worst supports the argument. It's a bit of a four-letter word in U.S.-China circles anyway, and people can't have really a level-headed debate about it. The references to the Cold War, there's a lot of things about the Cold War that we didn't like. The Cold War also saw the creation of the important institutions at the root of what we call the liberal order. The Cold War saw the United States going to the moon. The Cold War saw the greatest progression in U.S. civil rights in the modern era. The Cold War saw national unity and purpose. The Cold War saw more bipartisanship. There were a lot of really negative things about the Cold War, but I think the conception of the Cold War as somehow this horrible period of American foreign policy is something we need to rethink. What is the period of American foreign policy that we look back on as such a great period of American leadership in the world, if not the Cold War? So I think we need to revisit these concepts. A lot of them are so loaded, we ought not use them. And as I mentioned, I think the challenge ahead is coming forward with new concepts. I think for me, it's around the notion of American competitiveness.
All right, we're going to take two more. I think that's about all we have time for, and then we will vote again. And if anybody is raising their hands during the day on the two sides of these lecterns, please stand up because I apologize that I can't see them. Okay, so we'll go to the back over there, and then we'll come up here to the front.
Hello. Atarv Gupta, Thomas Jefferson High
Speak
School.
Speak louder, please. We can't hear you.
My apologies. Atarv Gupta, Thomas Jefferson High School. My question is, given Beijing's track record with skirting Obama-era agreements made with China, how can we improve diplomatic engagement in the future to reach equilibrium while still holding Beijing accountable to actually follow through on their agreements that are formed? Thank you.
Right. Okay. So how do we make engagement ultimately more effective in serving our interest? And we're going to come back to the front to Wuxin Bo. If somebody can bring a microphone here.
Thank you.
It's on.
My question for two panelists is really, I think countries influence each other, big or small. And for the major powers, the best way to influence each other is not really through arms race, trade war, or ideological fight, but rather through how they promote their social economic development. So in the case of U.S. policy towards China, in the long term, if you want to make your policy more attractive, effective to the Chinese people, the real question is how the U.S. can provide a good example in terms of your domestic governance and also your international behavior. At this moment, when people in China look at the United States, it's a joke. How can you say, you know, you can influence China's behavior because you are doing much better morally, politically, and in other realms? So I think that's a real challenge. It's not just a foreign policy issue. At the end of the day, it's a matter of your own governance and your own international behavior. Thank you.
Okay, U.S. and China, both competing models of governance, but the United States not providing a good moral example or a good model. Okay, Stape, you want to go first?
The first question is how to make engagement more effective in serving our interests. Mm-hmm. What you discover in international affairs is that for international agreements to work, they have to serve the interests of each side. When a duly agreed and ratified agreement ends up serving the interests of only one side, usually you cannot get compliance by the other side. In other words, agreements amount to formalizing a common concept of behavior which each side sees as serving some national interest of its own. But here's where you get contradictory behavior. Let's take protection of intellectual property. Going back 25, 30 years, China had people at the very top of the system who recognized that China could not create intellectual property as it aspired to do if it was unable to provide protection for intellectual property. The general pattern globally is the countries that produce the most intellectual property are the ones most interested in protecting it, and the countries that produce the least are the ones most interested in stealing it. So if a country has no aspirations to protect intellectual property, they steal where they can. And it's hard to prevent that, although in some cases you can do it. So China is conflicted because it is creating intellectual property. And if you read Li Kaifu's recent book about artificial intelligence, it turns out that China's discovering they're very innovative in adapting stolen technology, artificial intelligence to its use in China. But the problem is they can't protect the very creative adaptations, and so you have a very active competition situation to see who can produce the better improvements of stolen property, which is then stolen by other competitors of yours in China, and this creates a creative process which can actually produce better software. China's right in the middle of that fix. It now recognizes it has to improve protection of intellectual property, but it is a country that has habits of stealing intellectual property that the political system is not strong enough to stamp out. And so the problem is, how do you work in a direction where improvements of protection of intellectual property are taking place in ways that are meaningful to your companies? And that's the process that we've been trying to do. The Obama administration made a breakthrough by getting an acknowledgement from the Chinese government that stealing of intellectual property for economic benefit, for commercial benefit, was wrong. The French won't give us that commitment. They steal intellectual property for economic purposes, and in principle, they've never agreed that that's bad. They just do it. Well, China actually gave us a commitment, and it improved the protection of commercial property for a while, and now we think it's breaking down. So, it's a complicated situation. You never win that war. It's a constant struggle. It's like a police action. You win wars, but you never stamp out crime. So that's what you have to do on that front. Major power influences each other by promoting so-and-so. The best way for major powers to influence each other is to set good examples. And that's been the strength of the U.S. example, the so-called shining city on the hill we like to talk about and we relate to U.S. exceptionalism. No, there was nothing exceptional about that. The idea was that the United States should set an example for the rest of the world of how we were running our domestic affairs. And frankly, throughout our history, it was very, very effective. And right now, it's very ineffective because we're not setting a good example in terms of how we are running our domestic affairs. So if we want to have a responsible China behaving in a proper way in East Asia, that's the way the United States needs to behave in East Asia, and that will influence Chinese behavior. But if we want to have the right to intervene wherever we choose without consulting or taking into account the interests of other countries, then China will use that as a model for its own behavior. And it will have it could be a reverse process in terms of how that goes on. But my entire diplomatic experience is based on understanding if you set a good example, you really do influence people, although you don't always know it at the time.
Eli?
Completely agree with that last point and this intervention as well. I've described, my position on this now is that U.S.-China policy is not about changing China. It's about making the United States its best and strongest self. That's how the United States, I think Stape and I agree on this. The moniker that I use for the Trump administration is that they're confrontational without being competitive, and that we need to turn that around. We need to be competitive without being confrontational. The actual bilateral confrontation between the United States and China is actually the least interesting and important part of the U.S.-China competition, and it's going to be taking place in other domains, and we're not going to get to where we go by throwing punches at Beijing. I don't think what this is about. This is about the United States, again, proving the value of its system and its economy and its values to the rest of the world, not just pushing back on Beijing. So completely agree with the domestic policy argument. On the other piece about improving engagement, this gets back to sort of the core, maybe I don't know if this is our last round, but to get to the core of at the root of what we're debating here, and the question was how do we get more out of diplomacy given that what we saw over the Obama administration was this policy of engagement not working. It's a change in mindset because if you believe in at the root of the policy of engagement was this belief in convergence. And that over time, China was going to become, through this interaction, it was going to become a responsible stakeholder. Its economy was going to, over time, become more liberalized as we expected. If you believed that, then China's counter-normative behavior, whether it was in the South China Sea or on cyber espionage, was okay. Because over time, it was going to get less and less and less and less, and you could sort of just accept its warts because they were going to go away. And I think what we've discovered is that certainly under Xi Jinping, China's not in a trend. I mean, no one's talking about liberal democracy. I think that's a straw man. People are talking about very gradual social and economic opening. I think what we've seen under Xi Jinping is China's not transitioning, right? We're looking at China right now, and we shouldn't have expectations about some of these openings. And so then it gets to a question of what do you do about that? And I think some of the lessons during the Obama administration, and maybe this is what Ambassador Roy is talking about, improving engagement, is that in the very few instances when the Obama administration did put its foot down and made very clear what the consequences would be of China's counter-normative behavior and did it in a coordinated fashion, in a way that was balanced and measured, that China often did respond by curving its behavior, but that requires having credible commitments to impose costs and competing with China rather than just believing that commercial, economic, and social engagement was going to get the relationship where it needed to go on its own.
This has really been a terrific debate, and we are now going to bring the debate to a close, and we're going to give all of you an opportunity to vote again. So first, can you remind us what the debate was initially? So we started out with 65% voting yes, U.S. engagement policy toward China has failed, 35% voting no. I see not all of you in the room are voting, so we're now going to vote again, and I hope that more of you will vote. We'd like to see everybody in the room vote. I promise we can't track your votes, and we're going to give you 1 minute to register your votes on the proposition that U.S. engagement policy toward China has failed. I think a lot of this discussion, as has been correctly pointed out, does turn on how you define engagement. But I think we've had a very good discussion as to what has worked regarding the engagement policy and how it might be made more effective in the future. A lot of overlap also, I think, between our speakers. There certainly has been a significant amount of agreement. But this is representative of the debate that is taking place today in the United States in many quarters. So I think this has really been a terrific discussion. So we are now at 62%, sorry, is 85, 86 votes. A couple of more seconds here. Anybody else that wants to vote, please go ahead and register your vote. So we are, okay, I think we're going to close the voting here. We've had a little bit of a change, so Stape got another 3%. But the majority of people in the room, 62%, still believe that U.S. engagement policy toward China has failed. Please join me in thanking Ambassador Roy and Dr. Eli Ratner.